Hello, all. Welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Jacona's Books, which is an independent anarchist press that publishes socially engaged literature. With me, as always, are Chris Smallberg and Hans Berger, who are the other two editors of Kai Jacona's Books. And if you have been listening to past podcasts, then you'll know that today's podcast is going to be on John Steinbeck's East of Eden, which was my pick. I'll try not to be like, effuse all over this book. I really enjoyed it, really thought it was great. You know, I was a Steinbeck fan going into this. And I thought it would be good, and I, you know, if you're into Steinbeck, there's no reason you wouldn't like this novel. Though, admittedly, it does seem like there are certainly aspects that I could see that some people might take as flaws. And I'm not really sure exactly where I want to start. I mean, obviously, a good portion of the novel is kind of like a reenactment of the Cain and Abel story from the Bible. You guys can, you know, if there's anything I'm saying you disagree with or whatnot, you can correct me. But one thing I like about Steinbeck in general is that he's a religious writer. He uses a lot of biblical references in almost all of his novels that I've read. There's a component of looking at the Bible or looking at stories of the Bible and relating them to the events going on in whatever novel that he's talking about. The Grapes of Wrath is like that. To a God Unknown is like that. East of Eden is very much like that. So we've got, you know, a couple of generations of people kind of reenacting the Cain and Abel story. We've also got some, and that's the Trask family. We've also got the Trask's neighboring farmers in Salinas Valley, California, the Hamiltons. And the head of the Hamilton family, his name is Samuel Hamilton. He and the head of the Trask family, Adam Trask, kind of develop a friendship, and this kind of friendship reverberates throughout the next generation when Adam's sons grow up, Cal and Aaron. And, you know, there's also some other side stories about the Hamiltons, like Tom and Desi. It was an interesting, really sad side story, and maybe that's where I'd like to start. I feel like we do need to talk about how the Bible story plays out in the novel. I mean, I don't see how we could get through this podcast without talking about that. But maybe one thing I wanted to talk about was like, how do some of these peripheral characters like Tom and Desi or Will Hamilton, the businessman, how do some of these peripheral stories relate to the larger issue of the Cain and Abel story? You know, why do we have these in the novel, and what's the point of it being, you know, having all these stories about the Hamiltons when, like, thematically it seems the meat of the story is the resonance between, you know, the relationship between Adam and his brother Charles kind of flowing down to Adam, probably not Adam's sons, Aaron and Cal. So what about all what do you think these other stories do for the novel? Is that a good place to start or not?
I mean, I can respond to that. We'll see if it gets us anywhere.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think that the, if nothing else, my first thought is that you have to have these other characters in the novel, or it would be, I mean, the Trasks are all so blinkered, right? Like they are all in their own ways very, very poor at seeing and understanding the world and themselves. They're isolated, mm-hmm. they're unself-aware, they are they're very uncomfortable people to spend too much time in the headspace of, really, because they're all almost in their ways absurdly, frustratingly stupid is maybe too simple a word, but they are incapable of understanding and living in the world, right? And that incapacity is where most of the tragedy in the novel, I think, comes from, right? And so to give, I think partly just to make the novel tolerable and partly to have room for the kinds of philosophical discussion and thought that Steinbeck enjoys, I think you have to have these counterfigures who are all counterfigures like Sam Hamilton, right? Like all the people in the Hamilton family, like Lee, who's also very important in that regard. You have to have these other people who are able to, if not think clearly, if not see clearly, at least able to bring, they're kind of like a channel between the Trasks and the world as it really exists, right? Like maybe the characters are all, they all have their own flaws, they all have their own blindnesses, but they're almost like intermediaries between these the Trasks, who are incredibly isolated, both, you know, isolated on the farm in the first half of the novel, and then also kind of isolated by their own blindness. They're a vehicle that kind of allows the Trasks to somewhat interchange with the real world. I'm just off the top of my head, you know, thinking of Sam Hamilton, rather like violently, I think, snapping Adam Trask out of his sort of almost coma that he goes into when his wife shoots him and leaves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Adam Trask coming in and kind of shaking him out of that and saying, no, you need to engage with fatherhood. You need to name your children. You need to, you have this role that's been thrust on you and you need to perform it faithfully, right? Or right. Will Hamilton showing Cal how to make money in business, right? Which is something that Cal could never have figured out on his own. So they, to some extent, allow, I mean, if it weren't for the presence of the Hamiltons, the Trasks are so, they're so poor at being that they would probably, there wouldn't be a novel if it weren't for the Hamiltons, because the Trasks would all be dead. And also we would have no way to really kind of think about or address
right.
any kind of real question, because I don't think the Trasks by themselves are capable of reflection for the most part until maybe the very end.
Right. Hmm. Interesting. I think that's a good point. You know, I think I agree.
That doesn't necessarily address, for instance, Desi, right? Desi, the tragedy of Desi's passing. And that, that bit in particular is, I mean, that's a very sad digression. And I don't really know what it does, actually. I don't know what purpose it serves thematically. I don't know what purpose it serves narratively, right? I don't know if you guys have, I don't know if we want to dig into that incident in particular, but
I was curious about it because it ends part three, right? It's the last chapter, like, and I had a similar question. I don't have an answer though.
Like Desi dies, and then Tom writes two letters, one to his mother, you know, saying he got a new horse. And then the other one to his brother saying, I'm going to go shoot myself, tell my mom it was the new horse. Yeah. Hmm.
I mean, I don't know if it has something to do with, and I'm just improvising here, you know, but so much of the novel is about sibling relationships, right?
Right.
And sibling relationships that are kind of like all the relationships in this novel are so, so deeply clouded by lack of communication and understanding. Right. And Tom and Desi, in that little kind of moment they have where they join each other on the family ranch and they say, okay, well, we're going to save, we're going to travel. They kind of, they're both kind of at the ends of their ropes and they are trying to build a life together almost as kind of a last ditch. And then it fails essentially because, I guess because Tom's not good enough at spotting the symptoms of appendicitis, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know if that's some, I don't know, like, how that ties to, like, in some sense, that's, I don't know how that ties to the, it seems like the fact that they're siblings trying to kind of break through and failing, trying to break through that kind of wall of isolation that's around all these people and failing. I don't know if that's, that has to mean something, but I don't know that I can neatly articulate what.
Right.
And maybe it doesn't necessarily have to mean anything that can be neatly articulated, right? I mean, the thing about this novel is that there is, you have this kind of key allegory that's repeated twice in this very, very, in this way that's kind of almost, maybe overdetermined is the wrong word for it, but like, there's no ambiguity about how this key allegory is playing out. That gives me the instinct to say that everything has to have, everything else has to kind of be equally weighted and clear cut, but that's not necessarily true.
I mean, maybe all of the, you said, you know, the Trask family is so blinded. I liked that description. To that having the whole book be about them would be kind of, you know, for whatever reason, it wouldn't function. But maybe similarly, if the whole book were basically right angles and very clear broad strokes of allegory, because it maybe it works because it doesn't mean anything and it feels capricious and cruel and unlucky and kind of almost like a breach of meaninglessness.
So it restores the sense that this story is happening in the real world because it doesn't fit into the kind of thematic pattern that much of the rest of the novel does.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I wonder, like, you know, this is maybe a question for a different time, but like, is it really the goal to like trick us that into believing that this is the real world, or is it about kind of satisfying something similar, or, you know, like not convincing us that it's the real world, but convincing us that it at least honors that mysterious, frustrating, kind of chaotic element. At least something in the novel or something in the story has to have that. You know, I don't know. I guess I'm just sort of rephrasing what you're saying. I don't know that it has to convince us that it's trying to be authentic or realistic in some way. Because I don't think that it accomplishes that for me, but at least I feel, I don't know, if I'm thinking of Tom and Desi's story in the right way and how it ends, that it's not the same as Aaron dying in the war, right? Aaron dying in the war feels thematic.
Mm-hmm.
Tom and Desi, their end just as like a jagged crack through the middle of the book that kind of takes away some of the symmetry and makes it, I don't know, it does make it more palatable to me. I'm not sure if I could describe why.
And what about Like, clearly Kate has a role to play in the allegory and the in the.
I do want to talk about Kate.
Yeah, and but I was thinking that she, I mean, she definitely is like part of the catalyst for this second, second playthrough of the Cain and Abel story between Cal and Aaron, and she also has some. I mean, well, actually, she's kind of the catalyst for both, right? For both of the playthroughs, like between Charles and Adam and then Cal and Aaron. But so she definitely has that thematic role to play, but as a character, like she, I found her interesting and also like some of what we're talking about, like this tension between, you know, strict allegory and strict like thematic unity, and then these other things that exist within the novel, maybe as a way to balance those out and have much less thematic meaning and more are just kind of like interesting stories. I wondered how Kate fit into that, since she seemed to have a role in the allegory, but also like, what's the purpose of like her, you know, she's, I guess you would call her a sociopath, you know, what, so what's the deal with her, you think?
Well, I don't know that she, I mean, like you said, she is certainly a catalyst for the movement of the story, right? She's a catalyst.
Right.
I don't know if she's precisely, I mean, the two, by my understanding, the two reenactments of the Cain and Abel story are the knife and the dog, right, with Charles and Adam. And that's pre-Kate, so she isn't necessarily involved in that so much. But there's the knife and the dog, right, the gifts of the knife and the dog by Charles and Adam. And then the gifts of the money and sort of the living of a good life from Cal and Aaron, right?
Right.
And I don't know that she actually, I don't know that she has much to do specifically with the establishment of those scenarios. I don't think anything with the first one. With the second one, I mean, she catalyzes the move to California and, you know, the existence of the two sons. But I don't, off the top of my head, I'm not sure that she has much direct bearing on the particular kind of psychodrama of the matter of the two gifts. I mean, so I think in some ways, like, and you certainly can talk me out of this, right? But my thought on reading it was that she does kind of seem to sit somewhat outside of the neat allegory. Right. That she is, I mean, if she's anything, she would have to be an Eve figure. And, you know, and I don't know that, I mean, I guess like the, in a way, so the, what is it that is, what's the key thing about Eve, right? The key thing about Eve is that Eve initiates the understanding of the knowledge of good and evil.
Right.
That's her main role. And she's almost sort of a reverse of that, where like, as what we would, I mean, she's kind of like a, maybe a, we can get into the quality with which the sketch is done, but she's like an attempt to sketch what we would now understand to be a sociopath, right?
Right.
Pretty clearly. And in some sense then, I suppose, I mean, the idea of a sociopath, and, you know, this is, I'm thinking of this more in like a pop culture sense than in like a strictly up-to-date psychological sense, right? Because this
is from the
perspective of 1952, but in some sense, like she is unable to, like if she understands in an intellectual way the distinction between good and evil, she is incapable of feeling that distinction emotionally and does not wish to act on it, right? So in some sense, she's almost like a pre-lapsarian figure, like if the key idea of Eve is that she catalyzes the understanding of good and evil, Kate is a very kind of, she's almost like an anti-Eve in the sense that she exists outside of that knowledge or never fully acquires it, right? And so again, you know, I don't know if that needs to be necessarily fit into the allegory. I mean, I think there must be, again, some meaning there, but I don't know that it needs to be necessarily put into the exact contours of the allegory, you know?
I really like that because is it that she can't progress when she kills herself? Like Cal is examining the evil in himself, like the sin, and is sort of but he's different, right? And that's kind of, we should talk about Tim Shem too. She can't, and I don't know, she has, like that, like, and she realizes that, and that's something that like basically breaks her, and the only way forward for her is to die. And
I hadn't thought that that's like she like, I'm not saying you're wrong, I think that's interesting, like I hadn't totally connected that idea that Cal, like Cal's ability to examine himself and examine his own evil and is what, you know, makes her commit suicide, because she's not able to do that. But it would explain like her leaving all of her money to Aaron rather than to both Cal and Aaron, because, you know, she's, you know, is afraid of Cal or hates Cal. Interesting.
Yeah, I guess I had my reading of the decision to leave all the money to Aaron was that it's like a last ditch way to try to corrupt him, right? Or to shock him into to shock him, right?
Because that's a good one too.
He cannot receive that money without discovering that his mother was, you know, the worst woman in Salinas, right? So by willing him all the money and killing herself, she is essentially attempting to destroy Aaron, to destroy his innocence. I don't know if that's maybe, you know, I think both the things that you guys are talking about could be in play there, right? Like it could be both an attempt to destroy Aaron and also an expression of fear, or it could be directed at Cal in some measure too.
Right.
I didn't necessarily see her as being super conscious of where it's very, that's interesting. Cause I read her as being, you know, as this actually an attack upon herself, but that's very interesting. Sorry, yeah. Patrick.
No. I just, you know, interesting. She was definitely one of the characters that I thought, you know, she's super important, one of the more important characters, and yet I couldn't quite figure her out, and I still haven't, but I definitely think she's interesting, and like I agree with what I think you said this, Hans, that like she's the understanding of a sociopath from 1952. Like I mean, in that, like, I think there are parts of her character that very much make it seem like she's a sociopath. I mean, like, from my understanding, a sociopath is someone who doesn't have like a moral sense. You know, they don't feel guilt about, you know, stealing somebody's bike or lying or something like that. And, you know, right. And, you know, and this kind of plays itself out in the book, like she ends up being essentially like maybe serial killer is not right, but a murderer of opportunity, which, you know, is certainly not, you know, I could see why a real sociopath being offended by that. So maybe this is a bit of a, you know, kind of an anachronistic or an early understanding of what the personality disorder of sociopathy, or however you say it, would be. But to move on to something else. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't know if you have another topic you want to get to, we can. I was just wondering, how much do you feel like, okay, so like, I know that you mentioned that you recognize that some people could see flaws in this novel, right? And I think there are certain things about it that are sometimes perceived as flaws, but that also are admired by many people who are fans of it. And I'll be frank and say that in some ways, like, I mean, I thought it was obviously a fantastic novel. It's an amazing piece of work, and Steinbeck as a craftsman is top notch, obviously, right? And I certainly enjoyed it. I do think that I was maybe more in the camp of like the things that could be seen as flaws. I think I was more inclined to see as flaws than some other readers might be.
That, and you know, that was actually something that I wanted to talk about with you guys. I was gonna frame it a little differently, but this is something that I definitely wanted to get to.
Well, I was bringing this up while we were talking about Kate, because the character of Kate, how she's created, how she functions, is one thing that is sometimes, by my understanding of the critical writing around it, is sometimes perceived as a flaw, and that I had mixed feelings about, right? It seems like she's, like, for the most part, all these characters do, for whatever their allegorical functions are, they do feel human and specific, right?
Right.
And Kate sometimes feels more like an idea than a character. And yeah. I think that might be, and that's particularly troubling because the idea that she's incarnating now feels anachronistic, right? She's meant to incarnate an idea of a sociopath that is now outdated. And so I was just going to ask, how much you felt like she was working as a character versus an idea, and how much that the ratio between those two things either troubled you as a reader or didn't?
No, I definitely found her troubling. I found her troubling both like as a character within the novel, but also troubling as like, I think I'm siding with you specifically on her. I think she may be problematic. Not just because she's
aesthetically problematic.
She's aesthetically problematic. And mostly that's just because at the same time that I say that I think she's interesting, and I do think she's interesting, I also think she borders on one-dimensional. I think that, like, there are times when you empathize with her, like, you know, I think it would be horrible to be in her situation where she is kind of born with, you know, a disorder, and there's, you know, there's no understanding of it. There's no way to cope with it. And it just leads to all sorts of, you know, problems. But But ultimately she's just kind of a boogeyman for the story, maybe. And she doesn't, I don't know.
Yeah, and she is frightening as a boogeyman, you know? I mean, she's satisfyingly terrifying. And I suppose I'm not even sure that she, like, I can imagine that someone very, very much like her could exist, right? I don't even know that she feels totally inauthentic in that
right
way. And I did, I mean, if nothing else, you know, I had a sense, like, when we were being introduced to her character, I had that kind of, like, classic reader response sense of like, oh shit, like this is a big rock rolling down a hill and it's gonna flatten these two Everything. Other characters that I've that I'm already fond of, and you know, right. this kind of like I did have that sort of gut level fear response on behalf of right. Charles and Adam seeing that coming. So in that regard, I guess she's actually aesthetically very effective.
Yeah, I don't know. She's just super complicated. Maybe it's the fact that like I know you guys probably haven't read The Grapes of Wrath, but I'm gonna bring up a comparison to kind of explain how I feel. So, like, in East of Eden, I mean, it seems like Kate is the main female character. Like, of the female characters, she's the most important and the most prominent. And in The Grapes of Wrath, the main female character, the most prominent character, is Maw Jode. And in The Grapes of Wrath, Maw Jode is more like Samuel or one of these characters who's strong-willed and, you know, is very empathetic and is very interesting, and, you know, you kind of want to see what she does and how she's gonna, like, she seems to be in that novel a very strong central character. And so it's a little jarring in East of Eden, where your main female character is, you know, doesn't have any of those qualities. You know, Kate's not a likable person. You can empathize with some of her pain in a lot of ways, but you're afraid of her. You're afraid of what she's going to do. You know, I don't know that difference, like the fact that this is our main female character, maybe it makes me worried that she's going to come off as sexist or as like it's a misogynist thing. So maybe there's that fear there. I'm not sure.
I liked her best when we weren't in her head. When we bounced out to when she's the lead up to her killing Faye, the madam, yeah. And there's a length of time there, and this occurs with a few times. It's also leading up to when she kills her parents and a couple other places where we just kind of get descriptions of like how she's interacting with people, or like, you know, basically descriptions of action, and we know that she's lying.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I liked that too.
Those were great.
The outside word. No, I agree.
And I think those were compelling because they felt scary. It was like Zodiac, you know, like a Fincher movie or something like that, where you just feel this dread, like what's she gonna do? And those were effective, but then, you know, like, it's fun. So, like, as far as, like, her character, she reminded me a lot of, I don't remember, like, I think it's Nadine in The Stand.
Yeah, I remember that character.
Yeah, the one who's basically corrupted by the devil, yeah, by Flag.
She ends up as Satan's lady.
Satan's lady. But then Nadine is more interesting because Nadine wants to resist. Like, we get that story of her.
Right.
And then eventually she becomes like this, you know, manipulative, sexually manipulative, like, monster who, you know, who kills a lot of the people. It's been a long time since I've read The Stand. But
yeah, I haven't read it in a long time. I was actually thinking of rereading it for the new, like, limited series that's coming out. You know, there's a new one. I might as well read the novel again. But whatever.
Well, we get... it's been years, but I remember internality in Nadine being interesting because Nadine was having these dreams of, like, you know, Flag and was conflicted and everything like that. And that's what made her interesting when we were in her head.
Right.
And Kate is like, there's no contrast,
yeah,
you know, like there's nothing,
yeah,
in there. So she's great as a villain, but then maybe just not very interesting. Like,
right.
Maybe it's more compelling in the 50s, like you said, Patrick.
Right.
To be in the head of someone like her.
Yeah. If there are some aesthetic problems, I think Kate might be one of them. Though, again, like the way we're talking, we're not quite sure why. Like, we have some ideas. But on the subject of other of like possible aesthetic problems, so for me, the allegory didn't bother me. But I'm not, you know, I'm not actually a huge. I like some ambiguity and maybe a little bit more ambiguity. I think I like a little bit more than this novel has to offer, but I don't need a huge amount to be satisfied. And I wanted to ask you guys, since I was listening to this and I was like, man, I really freaking love this novel. Like, I'm riveted listening to this. But I feel bad because I think this is exactly the kind of novel that Hans and Chris would hate. And so I wanted to ask you guys about that, like, specifically about the allegory and its lack of ambiguity and whether you felt that was something problematic or if there were other problematic things you guys thought about the novel.
Well, I mean, I should say first that I certainly don't hate it, right? Like, I really enjoyed reading it. I'm glad that I got the opportunity to. I never would have on my own accord, right? And it is very, very, I mean, you know, Steinbeck is somebody who can execute a poor idea very well, right?
Mm.
And I'm not saying necessarily that the allegory is automatically a poor idea, but he could take a much worse concept and I think at a line level make it really engaging. And there is a kind of, it is an interesting, this doesn't engage with the allegory directly, but maybe I'll get there through this, right? Like, there's something just completely, I don't know exactly how to say it. Like, there's absolutely no ironic distance here, right?
Right.
And this is, I mean, this came out in 1952. This has to be, like, officially the last significant literary novel with absolutely no ironic distance. Like, this is the end of total earnestness, seriousness, straight-faced unironicness, right?
Right.
And that was, I mean, interesting, if nothing else. It's just like a different kind of mode in that regard. And it's also it's the very, very end of novels that are not in any kind of conversation or engagement with any other medium, right? Where, like, everything after this, even things that are set before the advent of TV and film, are still somehow in conversation with TV and film, right? Mm-hmm. Like, every novel set in the Old West, written after 1960, is partly about, inevitably has to partly be about how TV and film represent the Old West, right? For instance, right?
Sure.
Or like, if you are, you know, internal to your characters, any character who lives after the mid-50s, their relationship to TV, film, recorded music is like, it, there's no way to represent somebody without delving into that, right? So it's like the novel kind of after the mid-50s, it kind of ceased to exist in a vacuum. It ceased to exist independent from other media. It's like, and you know, you can make a TV show that doesn't in any way acknowledge the existence of literary fiction. But you can't write literary fiction that doesn't acknowledge TV after, like, just a few years after this novel, right?
It
just feels like something that's completely from another world relative to things that came out 5 or 10 years later, right? I mean, this versus Pynchon is just, this versus Thomas Pynchon, or this versus Don DeLillo, or this versus, like, there's a generational shift there that I think is very key, and this is just the very tail end of that. So it was, if it was not my kind of thing, I think that's a lot of why it was not my kind of thing, right? Is those two things, the absence of ironic distance and the absence of like intermediation.
Right. Sure.
And I don't know that I can connect. Well, I guess the use of the allegory, I think anything that was written after the mid 50s would somehow have to question the way that it's using this allegory, right? Mm-hmm. To use this allegory in such an overt way, it would have to, in addition to using the allegory this way, it would also have to acknowledge that that's kind of a cheesy literary device, right?
Right.
So that's another way in which it, I think, like, as you know, my understanding is that this novel met with a little bit of a cold reception, right? It was poorly received critically. And I think a lot of that must have been because it was like a novel from one time that managed to kind of circulate in the next time where things were just sort of done differently. You know?
Interesting. That's super interesting.
As for how the allegory worked for me, the first time the allegory is enacted with the knife and the dog, it made sense and it felt organic to the world of the characters, right?
Right.
It seemed like something that would have happened in that world, and it actually like made a persuasive case, I think, that the psychological underpinnings of the Cain and Abel story are valuable and you know, resonate.
Right.
The second time that it happens with the money, to me it kind of felt like
too orchestrated.
It felt too orchestrated. I just wanted to know, what life would these characters have led if they weren't artificially forced to enact this Cain and Abel allegory, right?
Right.
For Christ's sake, man, as blinkered as I've used that word before, but as like blind and ridiculous in some ways as Adam Trask is, you know, how much money is it? $10,000? Like, okay, you don't like the fact that that's war profiteering, but like, I don't know, like he's mature enough and engaged enough with the world through his work at the draft board that I just felt like at some point he should have thought, okay, like take this money and start a veterans charity, right?
Sure.
You know, there's
sure.
It felt like if he had not, it's like he had to respond to that gift a certain way to carry out the allegory. And it just, it seemed like it condensed the novel rather than expanded it for the allegory to have to happen at the end of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And I don't know that, like, with the first time the allegory was enacted, I felt like it seemed thematically, like there's a statement there about jealousy and love and parental relationships where it, like the first time the allegory was enacted, it took the Cain and Abel story and it actually made it feel like something that shed real light on like what it's like to be the child of a distant parent. Right.
Yeah.
And I liked it in that way. I liked how it worked the first time. The second time it didn't seem like it said anything beyond here's the Cain and Abel story, you know, but maybe I'm underrating it. I would like to be convinced that I'm underrating it.
Well, I think maybe you're underrating it a little bit. I agree that, like, I think that it felt too orchestrated the second time, but I did like how there were some minor differences that I liked. Like, for example, you know, I feel like the distance, like in the first case between Charles and Adam and their father Cyrus, Cyrus really is distant from Charles. Like he really does say that he loves Adam more. But in the second time around, I didn't actually feel that way. I felt like Adam, I didn't necessarily think that Aaron was Adam's favorite. So much. I felt like Adam did love Cal. So there was, so that felt like it was more like Cal's misperception than true distance. But I also liked, I think Cal's a little more, not necessarily more interesting, but more empathetic than Charles. And so I think that, I thought Cal was a really good character. And I thought that in making, our stand-in for Kane empathetic and interesting and you want him to choose good over evil, I thought that reflected strongly back on the myth itself, the myth of Cain and Abel itself, and making Cain more empathetic because Cal's more empathetic. So I don't think it falls as flat as you think it does, but I understand why you might take exception, but I do think it had good resonance with the myth. The original myth. So
I have a question too.
Yeah.
Is it the thing that Cal does that we kind of, okay. So what does Cal do fundamentally? He says, "Hey, everybody's lying to you about your mom. Here's our mom. Just, yeah. you know, it's interesting that I feel like if it weren't for the Cain and Abel allegory, it's like our understanding of that act is so colored by that allegory, right?
Right.
If we were reading it without understanding that allegory, I think the idea that he somehow kills Aaron, it would be much harder to get that reading without the allegory. And I don't know if that's deliberate necessarily, right? I think there's a point early on, and maybe it's Lee, I can't remember, but one of the characters tells Adam, okay, it may seem like you're doing them a kindness now to not tell them the truth, but you're not really, right?
Right.
So whoever says that is, it's either Lee or Sam, right? It's somebody who's one of the sanest, clearest-eyed people in the novel.
I think it's Lee.
Yeah, it's Lee, who's probably the one person in the novel that you would actually trust to make a decision of
right? He's a great character, I think, you know. But anyway,
he's fantastic. Yeah. That's that moment. God, I love that. And this is just to dwell on this aside a bit. Man, when he showed up and started speaking pigeon, I just thought, oh my God, this must be why nobody likes this novel.
Right.
You have
I was like, oh my God.
And then he's like, is he going to do this for the whole rest of the novel, right?
Right.
Is it going to be Charlie Chan for the whole rest? And then he's like, whoa, surprise, I actually speak just as well as anybody, and I'm well-rounded. Great move.
Yeah, I was like, oh, shit, did I just choose a mega racist book? You know? And then,
and that particular, it's like there's a surprise that was built into that move that would have been interesting even in 1952. And
right,
it's a
right.
writing decision that I think was, Steinbeck was lucky enough that writing decision has aged very well, right? Writing decision that's kind of it's designed to make somebody go to bat for a book in 2020, right? It happens to be very consistent with contemporary values. But all that aside, I just don't know how much is it unfair to Cal to think of him as killing Aaron, really, or doing anything? I mean, he may act out of malice, but is the thing that he does really so bad? And how much is the allegory coloring our understanding of what, in a vacuum of allegory, might actually be kind of the right thing to do?
Well, go ahead. Sorry. Chris. No. I've talked a lot. You go ahead.
Well, is Cal the more interesting, the most interesting Trask character because the novel is sort of pivoting out of allegory? The beginning, you're talking about distance, the distance of Cyrus, Patrick, got me thinking that kind of the reason that it works at the beginning is because Cyrus is weird and mysterious. Cyrus is weird and mysterious, and kind of the way that he interacts with his children and how we see him, and everything kind of leading up to Charles attacking Aaron and really legitimately like going in and getting a hatchet or an axe. He goes in for a weapon, I believe, and then Aaron escapes. Or not Aaron, Adam. Right. God damn, these names. Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. The C and A names, like, that's too much, guy.
Yeah, yeah. You didn't need to do that.
Yeah, yeah. We get it.
Yeah, but it works then because, like, you know, allegory is, like, it for whatever reason, it's mythical and it works in myth and like the mystery of myth and of like motivation and all that, it functions. And then we spend so much time in Adam at the end, like Adam, it doesn't, that's why maybe that scene doesn't quite make sense, you know, or like his motivation, you know, like suddenly like he's behaving in this mythic manner, but
right.
We've spent enough time to sort of understand his motivations and his internality and it doesn't quite function in the same way. And maybe like, I don't know, I guess like my question is, are we supposed to think of this book as sort of like a transition out of allegory into someone who's more rich and complicated and who, because it's weird. It's absurd for Cal to blame himself to say that he killed his brother, but that is actually a more modern or not a, that is like a psychological like believable kind of like space to be in, like, right, where you know, people around you say like no, like your brother, you know, your brother went off to the military and he, you know, into the war and he died, you know, like, yeah. Yeah, you did a shitty thing and for shitty reasons, but you didn't kill your brother and you certainly didn't give your dad a stroke.
Right.
But feeling like you did, that's real, right?
Yeah,
that's
something I think he Cal has reason to feel guilty. Like for,
yeah.
Like the sequence, well, makes sense.
Well, and I guess like it's interesting that like the first Cain and Abel sequence functions better as allegory. The second Cain and Abel sequence struggles to function as allegory, but maybe functions or could function, or is trying to do both and is sort of juggling it and maybe dropping some of the balls in trying to be both complicated, like psychological and allegorical.
Mm-hmm.
Like it just does, it can't do both, but
yeah,
it's trying, or is that, I don't know, like,
I mean, I think it's trying to do both, and I think that it's, you know, I'm not gonna say it's like a failure, but it's definitely a difficult thing to pull off, and maybe it doesn't pull it off.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess one of the questions that maybe we're circling around here is how you, if the allegory is imperfect, right? Or if the allegory, if there's tension between how we should construe the story per the allegory and how we would construe the same actions and characters without the allegory, if that imperfection or that tension, is that by design or is that a fault? Right,
right, right. Right.
And I don't know that, I mean, I don't think that there is necessarily an answer to that, but I think that your sense of, or a person's sense of how well that functions aesthetically, I suppose to a great extent is going to be predicated on how much they see design versus fault in some of the tensions there.
Right.
And the straying from the strictness of the allegory.
Huh. I also wanted to ask, in a somewhat shift of topic, what do you guys make of the very end? You know, where, you know, Chris, you mentioned we should probably talk about Tim Schull And I thought, you know, maybe this is the point where we ask, you know, what do we think of this ending, where, you know, they're all supplicating Adam, hey, please forgive your son. And what he offers is, you know, a verse from the Bible, thou mayest. And, you know, it's neither straight, it's not condemnation, but it's not straightforward forgiveness either. And I thought it was successful in that I feel that it complicates Cal. Because, you know, Cal's kind of inner conflict is, well, how am I going to navigate my kindness versus my malice? How am I going to do this? And, like, this final word in the novel, Temchil, thou mayest, is, like, a recognition, you know, that Cal has to do this. Cal has to navigate his malice versus his kindness. And I wondered, you know, did you guys find that ending successful, given that there's, like, not a resolution, where we're kind of left wondering what Cal will do? Will he navigate more towards kindness and perhaps deserve forgiveness or not? Like, is he like when Lee and Samuel and Adam discuss the Cain and Abel Bible story, and they're figuring out what Temchil means, and they're like, one translation says thou shalt, and then another one says do. So one's an order and one's a promise. But we get the sense that Cain, the biblical Cain, doesn't inherit this redemption or this goodness from God. And I was wondering what we think will happen to Cal. Is the allegory doomed to play out as it has been doing? Or is this a point of change? Is this a point where the allegory is no longer applicable and Cal can maybe navigate towards kindness?
Well, I think it's a liberation from the allegory, right? It's a way of saying, like, it's a liberation from the allegory. Or maybe it's, I don't know if it's precisely a liberation from the allegory, or if it's more accurate maybe to say that that reading of the word, as thou mayest, the revelation, when Lee and Sam and Adam discover that, the revelation that they have is that it allows an open ending, right? It says, right, okay, you know, you have within yourself the opportunity to transcend the worst part of your nature and do good in the world. And to have Aaron told, or not Aaron, to have Cal told at the end, you have within yourself the ability to transcend the worst part of your nature, why is the allegory bad, right? Not aesthetically, but why is it bad to live in the allegory? It's bad to live in the allegory because it creates a sense of closed-endedness.
Right.
It creates an inevitability. And to be told, you have the choice, right? You have free will over the outcome of your character, is liberating, because it says, okay, even though you've enacted this allegory, your future self is still within your own power. So I don't know if it's necessarily positive or negative, but I think the fact that we don't know for sure if Cal will become a good dude is thematically more significant than if we were pointed one way or the other as far as whether he can kind of redeem himself or not, right? So I mean, I liked it actually.
Oh,
and
okay.
And I suppose too, it also it casts the original Cain and Abel story into kind of a frees those characters even in a way, because it's a reading of the story that says that even Cain actually had the opportunity to redeem, right?
Right.
And we don't really know if he did or not.
Right. Interesting.
I liked it. I think that it, for the thing, I read it the same way Hans did, and kind of the same thing where, like, it's not necessarily telling, Cal's not going to necessarily be a good or a bad person, but he's going to be his own person. Mm. And maybe he'll be able to get Abra in the willow.
yeah. I think he definitely will. I think he definitely will get Abra in the willow. I think I have that same reading. Like, I'm not sure whether Cal is going to turn out to be a good dude, but the very fact that he can be is positive. Like, that there's the opportunity that he's not doomed from the outset. So I liked that, and it's the Grapes of Wrath, like, ends very similarly in that, like, there's no resolution. There's it ends on this, like, final cliffhanging note, and you're not quite sure what's going to happen to all of the characters. And I thought it worked really well in Grapes of Wrath too, and I found it interesting that the same author could pull it off twice, because this isn't really the traditional, you know, climax, falling action, resolution type ending, if we're following Freytag's triangle or whatever you want to call it.
And I suppose it's one way. I mean, we were talking earlier about how this kind of represents a mode of fiction that was reaching its end. In one way, it is a little bit more of a 20th century device and less of a 19th century device, right? To end on a note of ambiguity, and to make the argument that ambiguity is actually more satisfying thematically and story-wise than if, you know, I mean, you read a Victorian novel and it's very clear at the end, you know,
yeah,
who's going to be redeemed and who's damned, right?
And they were happy forever in Sanditon because they got married.
Right.
All right, gents. That seems like a natural place to shut things down, unless either of you, you know, has more to say or something to point out.
I think I'm satisfied.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks for talking about this novel with me. I'm glad that it wasn't like, I really was worried while I was listening to this. I was like, oh my God, they're going to hate this. So I'm glad that it sounds like maybe it wasn't your favorite, but it wasn't like the worst. So at least there's that.
Well, and you can only have so many favorites, right?
Right. Yeah.
Not everything can be a favorite.
Well, absolutely. Not everything can be your favorite. So, Chris, it is now your turn. What are we reading?
I actually did plan for this time.
Awesome, man.
I've never read it, but I believe probably both of you have. I was thinking Wiseblood.
What's her name?
O'Connor.
Flannery. I've never read it.
I've read it, but it was one of those grad school summers where I was trying to read like a whole comps list plus the stuff I would normally read for pleasure, and so I've read it, but I remember very, very little about it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Wise Blood, what you need. All right, cool. So you heard it, listeners. We're going to talk about Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood next time. So tune in, you know, click your little subscribe button on whatever podcast service you use and find out, you know, what that podcast is all about. Until then, peace out, comrades.